at WPFW.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Is genocide by any other name still genocide? Doctors who are following closely the atrocities both from afar and up close offer their perspectives on Gaza, and the name of their organization is DAG, or Doctors Against Genocide. And with boomers living longer and fewer babies being born, will the Social Security Fund really run out of money by 2033, or is that just another GOP talking point? Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. 10,000 women, 6,000 of whom were mothers, have been killed in Gaza since the beginning of the conflict between Israel and Hamas. As a result, there are 19,000 orphan children forced to live on their own on the streets of Gaza. 19,000. That's according to a United Nations Women's Report. Famine is looming on the horizon as things have slowed since a convoy of humanitarian aid workers were recently bombed to death. Meanwhile, still braving the task, face tremendous obstacles. Andrea De Domenico, head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, said aid deliveries within Gaza were facing significant checkpoint delays, and that last week, 41% of UN requests to deliver aid to northern Gaza were denied. The Ministry of Health in Gaza announced yesterday that the Palestinian death toll from ongoing Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip has risen to 33,843. The number of Israelis killed in the conflict, 1,410. That's according to Wikipedia. Again, this brings the total death toll to 33,843 and injuries to 76,575 since the Israeli-Hamas conflict broke out on October 7, 2023. That's according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The ministry said in a press statement that 46 people were killed and 110 were injured in five Israeli raids during the past 24 hours. If you look up the definition of genocide, it says, quote, the deliberate killing of a large group of people, especially of a particular ethnic group or nation, end quote. Is the world witnessing a genocide in Gaza? Most people will say that's a no-brainer. 33,843 Palestinians killed in 6 months and the bombing continues. Yet, the New York Times has a policy of systematically censoring words like genocide and ethnic cleansing in its coverage of Israel's genocidal assault of Gaza. That's according to an internal memo obtained by The Intercept this week. Well, we have a team of doctors who beg to differ with that policy. They're members of DAG, or Doctors Against Genocide. Joining us are Drs. Nadal Jabor, an internal medicine physician from Dearborn Heights, a Palestinian-American who began as a peace, human rights, and medical activist. He grew up in Palestine and witnessed the Oslo peace process in 1999. He moved to the U.S. and he founded Doctors Against Genocide. Welcome to What's at Stake, Dr. Jabor.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Verna, for having us. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to be on your show and to speak our truth. Here we have my co-founder, Dr. Karama Hawash, and one of our brave member doctors, Dr. Farashin, who just went on a mission to Gaza, a medical mission, to help the victims of this ongoing genocide.
Absolutely. So as Dr. Jabbour just said, also joining us is Dr. Karama Hawash, a pediatric neurologist at Boston's Children's Hospital. She was born in Egypt, raised in the West Bank, and has deep family roots in Palestine. Dr. Hawash leads Health for Palestine, Balada, aiming for health equity in Palestinian refugee camps. She's also a co-founder of Doctors Against Genocide, and she recently returned from Gaza. Welcome to What's at Stake, Dr. Hawash.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. And also Dr. Farashin Salebi is a clinical assistant professor at MSU CHM. She is a global health specialist and a humanitarian physician. She is a Kurdish-Iraqi immigrant who moved to the U.S. as a teenager in 1977 and has lived in Michigan ever since. She volunteers in conflict regions, including Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Gaza. And thank you for joining us, Dr. Salebi. Are you here, Dr. Salebi?
She's muted.
Muted by
me, okay. Good morning. Sorry, I was muted. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning, yes. Dr. Hawash, I actually want to start with you. When were you last in Gaza, and was it before or after the October 7th attack?
So I just want to clarify, I have not been in Gaza recently. Dr. Farashin is the one that has that was in Gaza and she came back. But I was last in Palestine in the West Bank in August of 2023. I wanted to go back in October, but since then I have not been able to get in. I am a Palestinian citizen of the West Bank, so I have a Palestinian ID, and because of our Palestinian ID that is related to the West Bank, it's very complicated for us, like Dr. Jabbour and I, it's complicated for us to get to Gaza because the Israeli occupation has given us different identity regulations. So our freedom of movement between Gaza and the West Bank is extremely restricted.
I see. Okay, well then let me ask Dr. Farashin, when were you last in Gaza, and was it before or after the October 7th attack?
Okay, so actually I've been in Gaza twice. I just returned from Gaza about 5 weeks ago. So during the war, we went on a medical mission with Rahma Worldwide. I was the team leader for the surgical mission. We had 10 surgeons, one anesthesiologist, and one ICU nurse with us. However, I was in Gaza last year, exactly a year ago, when there was no war. So this was for me like almost like a 1 year anniversary to go back, which was a completely different country when I entered.
So when you were there 5 weeks ago, it's one thing to hear figures quoted 19,000 orphans. But how does that look up close? How does that feel?
19,000 orphans, I think there is a lot more. I think those numbers that we see and we hear, they don't actually give justice to what's the true numbers. Because we're only counting, I mean, those numbers are only counted for the people that they were able to count, right? But we're not looking at the patients or, you know, children or women or, you know, basically everyone. We're not getting the true number. The number could be a lot higher, actually.
So how does it feel to see those children and babies just left to fend for themselves? It's just kind of hard for me to conceive of 19,000 children and babies orphaned.
So the only thing I can tell you, I'll tell you a personal story, actually. There was a patient of ours who was 9 years old in the ICU, was there for, obviously, from a trauma, you know, injury from a blast that was in one of our ICU. He was initially intubated. We were able to extubate him. He was mildly awake. I actually have a video of him He had burns everywhere. Of course, there's trauma, there was injuries, and he was by himself. He had no family. This poor kid who was at a point, sometimes he was actually in pain because we didn't have enough pain medication to give him. And also because of his respiratory status was still like challenging, we can only give him so much before we can compromise his respiratory status. And this poor kid, he kept staring at me and he was in pain. He was in agony and he had no one to soothe him. He had no parents. He had no, other family member there. And, I did sit with him for a little bit, but it was just heartbreaking that this kid is alone in the ICU, unconnected. And he also had a chest tube, when they place a tube in the chest to draw like the bleeding or hematoma, which means like blood that comes out too. So that's one of the procedures they used. He had a test tube in him. He had multiple IV access. He was actually covered with a lot of wound dressing. And he was on a non-rebreather, a mask that we put on the patient's face to help them to breathe. And this kid was literally just struggling and without any parent. And that story actually is just one story of so many kids that alone by themselves. It is absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's one of 19,000. And the others that aren't in the hospital, how do they spend their day?
So the other ones that another story I can tell you, we did have another family that the entire family died. The mother and two sisters survived. They had severe burn. The mother had 70% burn in her body. She was almost like non-responsive. She was in her ICU. The two sisters, same thing. They had 50% body burn. Eventually, the mom died. And then this 8-year-old came in. And, he was the only survivor in that family that came in to pick up their belonging. And when I say the belonging, the mom had a bracelet that they had to cut it because she was so burned and her body was swollen. They had to cut it and they handed this golden bracelet to this kid, this 8-year-old. He was in shock and, I don't think he knew what truly is happening. And then the two sisters unfortunately died the following week, despite all our medical effort from complication from their burn. Now, this 8-year-old, he was just there with his cousins, distant cousins, and basically one of the cousins took him to live with them in one of the tents that they're in Rafah right now. And so basically either family, they have to look after them, or honestly, they have orphan, some places they have a bunch of orphan kids together, but they need a lot of help. They do need a lot of help. They need a lot of care. They need shelters. They need education. They need a lot of care. And unfortunately, there is, like you said, 19,000 of them. And those are just two stories of these 19,000.
And Dr. Nadal Jabbour, according to the online publication, The Intercept, the New York Times has put out a memo instructing its journalists to avoid using the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing. The memo was written by Times Standards editor Susan Wessling and international editor Phil Pan and their employees, and says it aims to offer guidance on terms the paper has grappled with since October, when Israel's current siege of Gaza commenced. Now, I know you founded DAG, or Doctors Against Genocide, before the Gaza conflict, but do you believe genocide is taking place in other areas around the world, and how does that compare to Gaza, and what about in Gaza?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I think there are many genocides going on in the world these days. And the genocide in Gaza is the most painful one now. It's the most extreme, and it is genocide by any definition, any meaning of the world. Unfortunately, the mainstream media and the world governments always downplay the crime of genocide. Always try to brush it under the rug. Usually they are complicit in this crime because they do not expose the truth, the facts on the ground to their people. That's what enables the genocide throughout history. This is not the first time. This happened during the Holocaust. This happened in Rwanda. This happened in Kosovo. the world community, the world governments, the international system always fails the victims of genocides, always try to downplay it or not call it as such. And usually this leads to more suffering and more victims mm-hmm. being lost. Because if we call the crimes as they are in a timely fashion, we can prevent more loss in human life. Me and Dr. Karama, when we were seeking peace, actually, and we were a group of Palestinians and Israelis who are seeking peace, we came to the conclusion that the other side is not really interested in peace. They don't see Palestinians as equal people. They don't see them as people worthy of their inherent human rights like anyone else. They see the Palestinians only as a security threat, as a demographic threat, as terrorists, as violent people. We tried for a year or even more to find common ground. Please, I mean, peace is possible. There is always a way to make peace. But we realized that the way they look at us, the dehumanization, the pogroms, the land theft, the demolition of houses, keeping the Palestinians under separate laws and regulations, the apartheid system, not giving them citizenship, not giving them equal human rights, all these were warning signs and were elements of genocide. So we went on, go ahead.
When you say that you tried, did your organization reached out to their organizations and sought opportunities for discussion and it was turned down, or give us a little bit more about the details.
We did not have the organization at that time. We were there as Palestinians who were seeking peace, and we were among a group of 5,000 Israelis, Jewish Americans, Palestinians. It was a group that started after the last war in Gaza, which was in May 2021. And after that war, I mean, as usual, we Palestinian people are seeking peace. We want peace. We don't want this killing and bombardment against our people to be repeated every few years. We don't want our people to be living under oppression forever, for eternity, just because the international system is not listening to us and giving Israel, you know, impunity and the exception to be above the international law. And we thought, I mean, since we are living here in the United States and we understand the Western mentality and we can speak better English, we thought that if we talk to the Israelis in maybe a more sophisticated way and a more civilized way, we can reach a common ground for peace. So we tried with them for over a year. We had weekly meetings, weekly Zoom meetings. We have Facebook groups. We were, communicating almost 24/7. Me and Karama personally, we were there 24/7 with these people for 5,000 people for almost a year. Mm. And at that time, all what we wanted is peace. And we were compromising to the maximum that any Palestinian can give. As long as we can reach peace, it's fine. We can compromise. We can come to middle grounds and solutions. And despite all our efforts, we were rejected. Mm-hmm. We were seen only as a security threat, only as a demographic threat, only as people who are foreign on our land. And any thing that the Israelis can give the Palestinians is seen by them as a charity, not because the Palestinians are worthy of that, of their own rights as any other people in the world. That's all what we want, just to have equal rights to anyone else, like anyone else in the world.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Ndal. So has there been any opportunity to try to dialogue or meet with American Jews regarding the situation in Gaza, and in the attempt to try to get to agree to at least a ceasefire? Any efforts on your part towards that?
So American Jews, I mean, we have a group of American Jews like JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace, and
I don't mean the progressive American Jews. I mean the Zionist American Jews that really support, if even tacitly support, what's going on in Gaza.
Unfortunately, since October 7, all channels of communications between us and between them have broken down. They all went on the extreme. They all went to justify genocide using the right of self-defense as a euphemism, as an excuse to justify genocide of the whole people of Palestine. This genocide that has been going on for 100 years. And it took different forms and shapes. What we are seeing here is just the most violent phase of this genocide, the mass murder that's going on against the Palestinian people. But it did not start on October 7. We called it out long before, 3-4 years ago. And after we went on research and studying the mechanisms of genocide that happened other areas in the world, we found out that this genocide has been going on for 100 years. It's not from just 6 months ago.
Okay. Dr. Karima, from a humanitarian perspective, how important is it to actually name the conflict in Gaza a genocide? Wouldn't it be just as bad if it's labeled a humanitarian crisis? And I'm not advocating that it be called anything but a genocide, but I want you to explain why it's important to name it as such, and why the New York Times has instructed its reporters not to use genocide and ethnic cleansing.
It is a very important question, and I'll try my best to answer it. And I might not be the best person to answer it, but I'll try my best. Genocide has a particular legal connotation, so it is considered the crime of crimes, and it's a crime that needs the whole international community to stand against it. So when something is identified as a crime, there will be regulation to prevent it. There will be sanctions on the perpetrators. There will be punishment on the perpetrators. So there is a reason why, and the New York Times is trying to avoid it, because, I do not know their exact motivation, but I cannot help but think it is to protect the perpetrators from being affected by the consequences of supporting a genocide. A genocide is abettors of genocide, accomplices in genocide, are also legally liable for by law for committing this crime. So it is after the Holocaust, the international community came together after a lot of nudging by some activists who we are inspired by, like Raphael Lemkin, to put the crime of genocide on the legal map of the United Nations and of the international community as something that needs to be stopped, prevented, and called out immediately to protect people from the effects of it. So denial of genocide is almost as bad as, protecting people who commit a murder, in my view. So it is very important to call it so that we can actually be able to end it.
Now, Dr. Karima, you studied at the University of Jordan and trained at Henry Ford Hospital, correct?
Yes.
And your research focused on treatment for traumatic brain injuries. What effect do you think this genocide, these horrific experiences are having on the children in Gaza and the mothers and the fathers as well, in the short term and the long term?
So, this is a complete health hazard for the whole population. You can start from every aspect. The famine affects scores of mothers and infants and pregnant women and breastfeeding women. So unfortunately, we are going to be faced by an extreme, massive epidemic of malnourishment. And malnourishment in adults and children delays healing, causes mental health issues, causes significant intellectual disabilities. So this will affect health for decades to come, just the famine. Now, I am a brain injury specialist. These children and the adults have been exposed to massive bombardment. There is blast injury. There are kids who are missing pieces of their brain, missing their eyes, missing their their limbs. So the traumatic brain injury, again, it is an epidemic of that in Gaza, because almost every child who comes to the hospital has traumatic brain injury because they have been bombed. And that can cause significant long-term cognitive function problems, affects intelligence, affects learning, affects mental health. The amputations, 1 out of 10 children every day in Gaza gets, actually, I'm wrong, 10 children in Gaza every day has an amputation of some part of their body. And with amputation, we will need these children to have long-term rehabilitation that they do not have in Gaza. So now they lose their limbs, they are stitched, and that's it, instead of having physical therapy and occupational therapy to help them. So the massive health effect on the population is ongoing, has not stopped, and it's getting worse by the minute. And if we do not do something about it, it will get even worse. And it will lead to annihilation of, a significant percentage of the population. I cannot stress enough how dangerous what is happening in Gaza is.
I know you have family members there. Are you able to be in contact with them on any sort of a consistent basis?
Not consistent. People are the people that I know walk miles in order to get a signal so that they can send a text message or they can do a phone call. So we have lost contact with so many people that we know. We have lost contact with the doctors that we have worked with closely in Al Nasser Hospital and Al Shifa Hospital, because most likely they are either killed under the rebels or incarcerated by the Israeli army.
Dr. Sarashin, in terms of the hospitals, I thought it was some sort of an international law that that prevented hospitals being attacked during these type of crises, these conflicts. But it seems like there have been a number of hospitals bombed by Israel in this crisis. The 36 hospitals in Gaza were bombed. Does that constitute a war crime that Israel could be brought before the International War Crimes Court in The Hague?
So I'm not a politician. I'm not a lawyer, but, definitely bombing a hospital, hurting any aid worker, medical providers, just including doctors, nurses, paramedic. Those are all considered, violation of international law. The Geneva Convention and the, international law has a very clear rules. And one of the rules, and I will underline and bold this color, the, hospitals, healthcare providers are off, they should not be, they should be protected at all costs. However, as you mentioned, there is 36 fully functioning hospital in Gaza. When I went last year and when I went this time, there's only two, partially functioning hospitals in Gaza. One of them was the European hospital that we operated at, which considered a little bit, I don't want to say tertiary center, but it was like a more higher care hospital, which is technically not, if you look at the standards. And then we also had the Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital, which was in Deir Balah. Now, the European hospital was in Khan Yunis. That's where we were operating. We do have some other small hospitals, but they're not fully functioning. And when I say that, that means they don't have all the specialty, they don't have the OR, they don't have the trauma center. So when you don't have these access, they don't consider fully functioning hospital, or they've been, you know, bombed, or they've been like, you know, a lot of their providers that have either killed, like Dr. Karma was saying, arrested, or they've been disappeared, or they left. So it's really difficult to see that massive amount of patient that we're receiving every day with, you know, limited resources. And also, like I said, with the hospital we were operating on, we will have a lot of trauma come to us, even though they will be seen in a small hospital initially, those little small hospital that then they will transfer them to us. Now, transferring patient was a challenge as well. You know, the risk of being bombed, you know, even though they were in ambulance, as we've seen, many ambulances have been, you know, bombed. Mm-hmm. So these are also considered violation of international law. Like I said, I'm a physician. I'm not a lawyer, but it's there. It's in international law. And unfortunately, it's happening every day. Even Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital, when I was there, the week after I came back, there was an attack on it, on the vicinity of the hospital, right by the entrance. And I remember that because I was just there, and I know how close was it to the entrance of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that I don't know if you know, that the hospital right now are considered like a shelter. Basically, you walk in, there are patients everywhere. I mean, civilians, they're sleeping in every corner of the hospital. They're in the hallways, they're in the by the elevators, by the stairway. In the backyard, they're full of thousands of patients. I'm sorry, civilians. So, and that was the case in the Shifa Hospital and Nasser Hospital and all the other hospitals. Yet, as you see, you know, we've witnessed all of us that they were destroyed completely, especially Al Shifa Hospital. And when I went to the Nasser Hospital, it's not actually operable right now. It's not functional. So it's, I think it is considered as a violation of international law. It is considered a war crime. I mean, I think anyone can say that.
Okay. That was Dr. Farishin Silevani. We've also been joined this morning by Dr. Karema Hawash and Dr. Nidal Jabbour, all members and co-founders of Doctors Against Genocide, or DAG. Thank you all for being my guest this morning on What's at Stake and sharing your firsthand accounts and perspectives on this horrendous conflict.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Berna.
You're welcome. Up next, since boomers are living longer and fewer babies are being born to fill the work roles, does that mean Social Security will run out of money in 2033, or is that just a GOP talking point to be able to cut the benefits? I'll pose that question to Nancy Altman of Social Security Works when we come back. Back in a moment.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m., and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whispers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Social Security program is facing a long-term funding shortfall of $22.4 trillion, a problem that can be attributed to the aging population. Specifically, birth rates have fallen and life expectancies have lengthened since the post-World War II baby boom, and retirees are now increasing in numbers more quickly than workers. Nancy Altman is with Social Security Works. Good morning, Nancy, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the ratio of workers to beneficiaries has dropped from 8.6 in 1955 to 2.7 in 2024. That's according to the Social Security Administration. That, of course, is problematic because Social Security is primarily funded by a dedicated payroll tax. Nancy, explain exactly how that works for our younger listeners who may not be familiar with that system and that process.
Let me reassure everybody that although those numbers are technically correct, they're a factoid. Social Security is extremely affordable. It, in fact, it's extremely efficient. Its benefits actually need to be expanded, and we are fighting to expand those benefits. They can easily be paid for if we require the millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share, which they're not doing. So that worker to retiree or to beneficiary ratio, that's true whenever a pension plan starts, you know, because you've got everyone paying in and very few collecting benefits. And that 1955 number, I mean, you could have started back in 1940 when the first benefits went out. You could say there were millions, the ratio was a million to one because there were millions of workers or hundreds of thousands of workers at that time contributing and very few collecting. And in 1955, that was after the number of people who were covered was expanded greatly. President Roosevelt wanted this to work, so he started incrementally. He started with just industrial workers and expanded out from there. That 3-to-1 ratio has been there since the 1970s. There's no question that that's not a problem. And in fact, the way to change that ratio is to increase immigration, because even though the birth rate has dropped, immigrants tend to be younger. They often have larger families. We should have a more humane immigration policy, and that would actually help Social Security extremely.
Wow, that's interesting news. That's the first time I'd heard that immigration could actually help to solve the Social Security problem. So I'm assuming that means that they will be on payrolls. And
exactly.
Paying part payroll tax, part of their payroll taxes will go to the system.
Exactly. It's a current funded system. It's insurance. What Social Security is, although it's not often called this, it's wage insurance. It's a very modern, you know, people say we got to modernize Social Security. It's a thoroughly modern concept. As long as people are dependent on their salaries and wages to meet their necessities of life, you need insurance against the loss of those wages. You can be unemployed. And in fact, although we don't call unemployment insurance Social Security, it was part of the Social Security Act of 1935. You become old age, you get retirement benefits, you become so disabled you can't work. Social Security has disability insurance. And you die leaving young children, you have survivors or life insurance. So the system really makes sense. It's important for all of us. And just one more point on the immigration, although you'll never hear a politician say that, and it's actually kind of an outrage. Undocumented workers contribute the most to the system because they often pay in under false Social Security numbers. And even if they become documented and the Congress has said, and even then they can prove that those were their contributions, Congress says, nope, you cannot get those benefits, even though these are benefits that are earned. They're part of your compensation.
So Congress is saying that documented immigrants would not be able to get Social Security, even though they have paid into the system?
The documented workers can, but for periods, if you were undocumented and paid into the system, those years would not count. But the basic bottom line point is that Social Security is very affordable, and it's not a problem, it's a solution. We're facing a retirement income crisis. Social Security is going to be even more important in the future, and the benefits are just too low. It works. It's extremely efficient. It's extremely secure. It's universal. Its one shortcoming is that its benefits are too low. And interestingly, this election really shows as a stark choice. President Biden and the Democrats want to expand Social Security, and they want millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share. Donald Trump and the Republicans want to cut Social Security, and they want to give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires.
So you're saying, yeah, there is a serious crisis with Social Security, and it's not that the system's going to run out of money. But if we continue the way we're going, and that nothing is done to in terms of forcing billionaires and millionaires to pay their fair share, the system would run out of money, would it not?
Well, it will never run out of money because it's current funded. So if as long as there are workers working, there'll be money coming into the system. And of course, if there isn't, that would mean we'd have much serious problems in Social Security. But it does forecast in about a decade a shortfall, which is unsurprising. Whenever you project that far ahead, you've got to project what the labor force participation will be, what the fertility rate will be, all kinds of complicated issues. And there are about 40 actuaries of the Social Security Administration who are crunching those numbers. Whenever you, and they are going to be coming out with a trustees report, which they do every year, whenever you show that there's sometimes an unintended surplus, there's sometimes an unintended shortfall. What the last trustees report showed was that starting in 2034, if Congress did not act, there would only be enough money to pay about 75 cents on the dollar, maybe 78 cents on the dollar. And of course, that's not nothing, but it's not good enough. And in fact, I feel quite confident that if Congress ever didn't act and that happened, there would be this automatic cut in benefits. They not only would not be voted out of office, they'd be probably run out of town on a ramp. I mean, there's no way that that's going to happen. So it is fear-mongering. Basically, what the Republicans are trying to do is say, you know, there's a potential of a cut in the future, so we'll cut your benefits today. It makes no sense. What we need is just more revenue. Jeff Bezos makes millions of dollars every single year, but he claims for his Social Security covered earnings $80,000. So people who make $90,000 are contributing more to Social Security than Jeff Bezos. That makes no sense.
So some of the solutions, the only solution that the GOP is coming up with is to cut benefits.
I think cut is a nice word. It's the slash benefits. They have very deep cuts that they're proposing. They have a group called the Republican Study Committee in the House of Representatives that represents about 80% of the Republicans in the House and all the Republican leadership. They come out with annual budgets that include Social Security, even though Social Security does not add a penny to the deficit because it has to be self-financed. It doesn't have any borrowing authority. Nevertheless, their budget that just came out in March cuts in the first 10 years alone $1.5 trillion from Social Security. It cuts $73 billion from Social Security just in the first year. And that is not only wrong, it's unnecessary. We should be expanding the benefits. And if we require those earning over $400,000, nobody else has to pay a penny more, those earning over $400,000 to contribute on all their income earned and under, there will be enough money to not only eliminate the shortfall, but dramatically expand benefits. In fact,
I can think of one way to expand it and to fund the program, which I haven't, to my knowledge, really heard too much discussion about. What about those billions of dollars in military dollars that we're sending to Israel to bomb in Gaza? Can't some of that money be diverted to fund our Social Security so that seniors, and getting close to home here, have adequate money to live off of after having worked.
I think you're making an excellent point. And although I think that's part of the general fund, which already has a large deficit. What we should do with those dollars, and we should definitely be cutting the military budget, is there's a lot of waste. And on top of what you're talking about with the really immoral use of our military equipment, there's an enormous amount of waste. That should go to Meals on Wheels, to services for seniors. It should go for the environment. There are all kinds of uses for that. The beauty of Social Security is that the revenue is dedicated, so it does not add a penny to the deficit, and it should continue to have dedicated revenue. That was part of the genius of Franklin Roosevelt. It is our country's most important anti-poverty program. At least about 22 million people out of poverty, including a million children each year, and less than the poverty of millions more. But we can do much, much more if we expand those benefits. But part of the reason, if I can just make one more quick point, Bernie, you know, as polarized as the nation is, and this is the genius of Roosevelt, you look at poll after poll, MAGA Republicans agree with socialists that nobody wants to see Social Security cut. Everybody understands it's more important than ever. People would like to see it expanded, and we all understand the wealthy should pay more.
But is that getting to the politicians that will be in charge of, you know, solving this problem? And it seems like this is now a very imminent problem. Would you say, is there a point where things could really get critical, Nancy, in terms of the funding that's available right now?
And, you know, one of the things Social Security is supposed to provide, in addition to the cash benefits, is security. It's a sense of peace of mind. And I really think that the politicians, they get how the American people feel, which is why, even though the Republicans have come out publicly for cuts, they're on record as it. When Joe Biden accused them of that, Marjorie Taylor Greene yelled out at the State of the Union, "You liar." They want to go behind, the Republicans want to go behind closed doors and cut your benefits without you knowing it, and then come up with a package that you have to vote up or down, and everybody can say, "Oh, we didn't want those," and you have no one to blame. President Biden has called that a death panel for Social Security, and I completely agree with him. If Congress acts in the open, which is what the Democrats want to do, the American people can watch, they'll know who to blame, and the program will not be cut. But if they go behind closed doors, then everybody should hold on to your wallets and watch out, because that's, and the Republicans at first were trying to hold the debt limit hostage to cut our Social Security. Then they tried to hold the funding the government hostage. And we fought hard against this so-called commission and have won so far. But you know, the people who want to destroy Social Security are not going away, and we have to just remain vigilant.
Now, do you think Social Security is going to be a prominent issue in this upcoming, in this presidential campaign? It sounds like it should be, given the time frame that we're working on to try to resolve this issue.
I hope so. And President Biden appears to be, you know, he's made some ads about it. Donald Trump is a little bit, as he is about everything, he's all over the place, because he claims he's against all cuts, but every one of his budgets when he was president proposed cuts to Social Security. Before he started running, he called it a Ponzi scheme. So I think there really is a clear choice. And if seniors recognize, in fact, everyone, but seniors particularly recognize that their Social Security is on the ballot, that along with Dobbs and reproductive freedom and Gaza, I mean, the hard part is that even though Donald Trump would be worse about Israel and Gaza, he's, you know, buddies with Netanyahu, you know, I understand so many people just feel morally they cannot vote for President Biden, and that obviously could hurt. But if enough people recognize that despite, you know, that Trump is worse, and that the if they want to protect reproductive freedom and they want to protect their Social Security, they should vote for the Democratic. And if they do that, if the House turns Democratic, if the Republican, if the Senate remains Democratic, if President Biden were Democrat in the White House, I actually think that we will start seeing, there are bills that have been introduced to expand benefits and eliminate the shortfall. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have one that would expand benefits across the board by $200 a month. There are others that in the House that expand benefits across the board with date and give child care, caregiving credits and all kinds of other better benefits for widows and so forth. We would start to see some votes on those bills, I think, if the Democrats are in charge.
So what exactly has Donald Trump and or the third party candidate, Kennedy, I think it's Joe Kennedy, said? What are they on the record saying with regard to Social Security?
Well, you know, most politicians today say, we want to save Social Security. We love Social Security. But if you really pin them down and say, well, do you say we will not cut Social Security? Oh, no, you know, we need to come have all options on the table. And that's Washington speak for, they're coming after you, Social Security. Donald Trump, before he started running, talked about raising the retirement age, talked about privatizing it, called it a Ponzi scheme. But once he started running for office, he got the politics and said, I'm not, the other Republicans are going to cut your Social Security, I won't. But then when he became president, he every single one of his budgets included Social Security cuts. Now he's back to saying, oh, no, I'm not going to cut your benefits. But those of us who follow it closely, it's absolutely clear that the Republicans want to cut Social Security. And he's a little bit like he is on Roe v. Wade and abortion. He doesn't care what it is. He just wants to do what politically will work for him. And I don't know about Robert Kennedy. I mean, he's off on anti-vaxxer and all that other crazy conspiracy stuff. But a vote for anyone but the Democrats is a vote for Trump, and that's the concern.
So here's what kind of disturbs me. If the Democrats do win the Congress and the Senate, will they still be able to pass that legislation that would require billionaires and millionaires to pay more in terms of their tax? That hasn't really been all that successful in the past.
Well, here's what would happen. They will bring it up, and of course in the Senate and the Republicans will have a hard time because they won't want to vote for it, but they won't want to vote against it. They won't want to come up with an alternative. So I don't know what they'll do, but there'll be enough Democrats that will pass the House. The Senate, they'll probably filibuster it. But you know what? Then it becomes an election issue in 2026. And enough of them lose, we will eventually get that. They will come around because it's like what's going on with Roe v. Wade. It'll be they'll be forced to come out with a clear position, and it will be a very unpopular position.
Okay. All right. Nancy Altman, President of Social Security Works. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thank you for listening. And I want to thank our engineer, Michael Mosella. Next week, Denise Young will be sitting in for Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. And as I'm Verna Avery Brown, in the words of the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Issei Williams.
best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whispers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whispers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams, recently appointed Interim General Manager. I want to thank each and every one of you who supported WPFW during our recent relocation drive. You are the fuel that keeps us going. We appreciate your generosity and the collaboration of building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Please know we all love you madly.
Brother to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east, my brother.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes.
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of DC communities east of the river on To the East. Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3
FM. The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice.
I testify.
Sophie's Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now and interview